Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
One thing that software developers are always trying to do is figure out how can they get us to do the thing. Whatever the thing is, click on the link, buy the product, doesn't matter. Just continuing to interact with things on the website. And what they do is they keep changing up the site, the link, the shade of blue, whatever it is, in order to figure out what are the things that are actually going to change our behavior. In other words, they're engaged in, at some level, manipulation of what we do. This is called A-B testing. They try different things. Does A work? Does B work? Which works better, A or B or C or D? And you might think, as my guest today, Kenneth Bowles, does, that this is ethically problematic. Kenneth is the author of a book called Future Ethics, and he's also the managing director of a company called Now Next, where they help people develop ethically sound products. I've known Kenneth for a long time. We've had many conversations about this sort of thing. And this is a really great conversation where we explore his view that A-B testing is often ethically problematic. One distinction that I want you to pay attention to is the ethical credentials, if you like, of the testing itself, regardless of what kind of impact or results that experimentation has, versus the ethically problematic impacts or results of A-B testing. So talk about that, just the testing versus the results of the testing, and how both might be ethically problematic. As you can imagine, when we're talking about testing on people, the role of autonomy plays a very large role. So is it the case that if people consent to using certain sites, that they're granting their consent? If people grant their consent to use the site, are they thereby granting consent to be manipulated in this way or that by virtue of the site being designed this way versus that? I raise objections. We talk about whether the problem is with experimentation or whether it's really just whether Kevin has a problem with marketing in general, whether marketing is ethically problematic itself. And we even talk about the role of capitalism in all this, whether the problem is that it's manipulating or changing people's behavior in pursuit of profits. So it's this pretty wide-ranging conversation. It's really great. Kenneth is a great interlocutor. And so I hope you enjoy the conversation. My name, by the way, is Reid Blackman. I'm the host of this podcast, Ethical Machines. And I don't know, I'm not going to tell you to do anything, like subscribe or anything. I'm just not going to do it. I've had enough of it. Too much. All right, let's go talk to Kenneth. So Kenneth, you've got this view that I find, I don't know, I kind of want to shrug my shoulders, and you're going to tell me why I shouldn't shrug my shoulders? You think A-B testing is morally problematic? Companies are doing it. I know that companies are doing it, but they're doing it either in a problematic way or A-B testing is intrinsically ethically problematic. What could possibly be the issue here?
I just wrote about this in the title for the paper that I wrote was Where's the Harm in A-B Testing? Because, yeah, people presume that it's benign and not a problem. My claim is that A-B testing can be far more morally complex than people think, and tech companies need to be significantly more careful when using it.
So give me an example where things go sideways, ethically sideways, because they engage in A-B testing. As I think of A-B testing, by the way, I think of ads. Mm-hmm. We're going to try an ad with this copy and then with that copy, and we'll see what people actually respond to. We'll see what they click to, and then we'll run more of that. That's my go-to model for thinking about A-B testing. But do I have that model right? And if so, give me a problematic case.
So I'll start with probably the more benign end of things, and then I'll end up with some examples that your listeners may well be familiar with that were actually A-B tests as well. So yes, varying copy in things like ads or on, you know, buttons and so on web apps or whatever it might be, that is commonly done. And the immediate reaction is, well, what's the big deal? You know, all you're doing is you're experimenting with your product. So Google, for example, they once tested 41 different shades of blue for their links on search result pages to see which ones converted best. And this was sort of this notorious example. And there was a famous designer at the company who left and said, this is insane. I'm not going to design for a company that micromanages everything like this. That sounds right. That's fine. I don't have a huge deal with that.
It's objectionable from a sort of tedious perspective.
Oh, it's objectionable to work there as a designer in that.
Yes,
for
to
sure.
Work like
yes,
that.
To be undermined, if you like, by micro testing of everything. But you know, c'est la vie, it's Google. That's the way they like to operate. But the more problematic, and you have OkCupid, for example, who in 2013, I think it was, they ran an A/B test on their site where they essentially took a proportion of their users and lied to them about match quality. Whole point of OkCupid is that you sign up and say, show me people who I might get on with romantically. And of course, then you go on dates.
Yes. I was on OkCupid not in 2013, but earlier than that.
Well,
sure.
You never know. There's a chance you're in one of these experimental buckets. I don't know.
I might be married to
the
wrong
person.
Exactly.
And it will be OkCupid's fault, or at least they would be complicit in that decision.
Yeah. I didn't meet her on OkCupid, but yeah. Okay. So they lie to you. That seems more morally objectionable, but not because it's A/B testing, but because they're lying to you that this person is a match, then it's going to cost you some time and missed opportunity to go out
and
with this person.
Potentially,
blah, blah.
Could be dangerous as well. If you trust this site that you know, this person is going to be a good match for you, and you put more faith in that sort of algorithmic decision, if you like, than you ought, then you could enter situations that are potentially dangerous for yourself. So it sort of undermined a core promise, if you like, of the site, which was, we'll find you good matches. And they essentially did this to see what happens, to see, do people trust the algorithm, or do people kind of reappraise things from first principles and say, I'm sorry, the algorithm is wrong, and therefore, actually, I'm not going to go on a date with this individual.
Sorry, two questions. So were they trying to see how deferential people would be to their recommendations? And also, is this a case of A/B testing or just testing out a hypothesis about levels of deferentiality by their users?
They weren't enormously explicit about the research question they were trying to identify. Their chief data scientist, a guy called, I think, Christian Rudder, was quite well known around that time. He'd been writing all sorts of blogs about...
I read those at the time, actually. I thought they were impressive.
They were good, but he attracted some criticism for his lack of interest in moral issues around the work he was doing, for example. Okay. And this was one particular example. So it wasn't entirely clear why. Frankly, one of the reasons appeared to be because they felt it would be interesting and potentially funny to see what happened. There wasn't a clear sort of defined scientific research question. It was more just kind of, hey, what can we get away with? Will people actually find out that we're doing this or not? Out of pure curiosity.
Yeah, that seems morally objectionable because it's a kind of negligence or something along those lines, or it's just not caring about people at all, or it's fucking with them.
Yeah, I mean, I see it as essentially you're sort of treating people as not sort of autonomous and valuable people, right? You're seeing them almost as playthings that we can, let's just try this and see how the masses
respond.
How
does the animal react?
Exactly. So it's not really valuing people as they ought to be valued. The other one for me is, particularly with that case, it sort of undermines a core promise that's been made to you when you sign up, which is that we will act in your interests, right? That we will perform this particular defined function. And you have faith that they'll do that. And then they just say, psych, we're not going to do that. In fact, we're going to do the complete opposite of that. Yeah, it's a problem.
Yeah.
Now, that was conducted through an A/B test. So they just...
Yeah. Okay, that was my next question. I didn't want to be too nitpicky about claim about A/B testing, but it doesn't seem like an A/B testing problem. So yeah, why is it an A/B testing issue as opposed to just don't fuck with people?
You could argue that maybe it's not the problem specifically of the medium of the A/B test. But one of the things I go on to claim is that actually the sort of the mentality of testing often incentivizes tech companies to see people as mere means for your own, you know, success, right? As
or scientific curiosity
as masses to be manipulated so that red lines go up. And so you're right. You know, maybe we could say, well, any sort of experiment of that particular nature is problematic. But my argument is, this means sort of this method encourages it. The other example I think your listeners will know is the emotional contagion study. This was a notorious Facebook study conducted again in the sort of mid-2010s. Essentially, to try and understand, are people affected by the emotions of those around them? And this was a sort of a social science hypothesis.
Oh, yes. Yeah, sure.
And so Facebook partnered with Cornell, I believe, and said, we have an opportunity to test this. And so they essentially altered the newsfeed of 689,000 users without their consent. And they altered it by hiding or showing happy or sad content. Accordingly, they had a happy bucket and a sad bucket and basically a control group.
Yeah,
which is the A of an A/B test is your control group, and the B is the variant. So you can have an A, B, C, D, etc. with multiple arms, if you like. And they found that, yes, essentially the effect was very small, but it was statistically significant that people surrounded by happier content from their friends would post happier stuff, and surrounded by sadder content from their friends would post sadder stuff. And the biggest problem here was consent, right? That no one knew this was going on. So one of the parts of my claim is that essentially, if people are experimenting with you, particularly when it's things around, you know, trying to affect your emotions in meaningful ways that have results on your own well-being, you probably should feel disgruntled if you are not told that that has happened, that's happened, right? That you are being included in that experiment. So the consent issue was one, but there was also a well-being question of, well, what if these users have anxiety or depression? There wasn't really any mitigation. It sort of fell through the cracks of Cornell's IRB and Facebook's reliance on terms of services, and these things really weren't looked at in the way they ought to have been. So there was a huge outcry about this at the time.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. So there's a couple of things I suppose I want to ask you. One is, there's one thing that you might think, which is something like there's a moral problems with particular A/B tests, something like that. That's one kind of claim. And that claim is certainly at least potentially borne out by the examples that you just adduced, the OkCupid one, the Facebook one. But I take it that your more general claim is something like, no, A/B testing just encourages a certain kind of attitude towards people. Number one, you call them users. And number two, you treat them like animals to see how they respond to stuff. And it's that A/B testing itself encourages an unethical attitude towards people, as opposed to this A/B test is wrong, morally wrong, or this A/B test is morally wrong. It's that A/B testing, or maybe you want to say the culture of A/B testing, or I don't know, something in that area is problematic because of the kinds of attitudes it fosters towards people. And then, of course, we get that. That's what explains why you get the particular ethically problematic cases that we get, like the Facebook and the OkCupid.
Right. So what I do explicitly is identify there are certain non-ideal cases, if you like. So I set out an ideal case where there's minimal harm. And then I say, okay, well, I still think we're doing this wrong because there is no real attempt to gain consent. And there ought to be some, albeit a fairly low bar of consent for these types of experiments, particularly when it comes to, you know, children, for example, who aren't capacitated to give consent. They're routinely included in these experiments. But then I set out, these specific cases. So for example, if you're conducting scientific research, or if you're working with vulnerable users with whom you might have a differential impact, so who might feel quite strongly different reactions in terms of not just their attitudes, but also the effects it has on how they use the product and service in question. So identify some of these specific sort of non-ideal cases, and I say, here are some of the strategies that need to be in play. Here is the higher consent bar that needs to be operated, or here are the things that companies ought not to be doing. But you're right, underpinning this is the idea that the very nature of putting experimentation right at the heart of how websites and apps are, how we believe they must be built, because there's been this strong kind of empirical turn among product managers, particularly to say, it's all about the data, just test everything. So you have Duolingo, Amazon, Booking.com, they test literally every single interface change. And that, I believe, does set up this mentality where not only does it devalue the expertise of people, you know, such as researchers or designers or product managers who will know a lot about how these things will land inside the company, but it also encourages this mentality of, essentially, these users are actually here for us to achieve our goals. And what happens is you see this slow slide from a product experimentation focus to a, essentially, how can we change user behavior in a way that benefits us without any consideration really given to the well-being of the user?
So I mean, I'm inclined to say maybe this is wrong. Okay, there's a couple things I have to say. One is A-B testing the problem, or is that a sort of symptom of the problem? Because A-B testing is how you get something else. A-B testing is how you optimize, specifically. It's how you get the optimal X, where X is engagement or clicks or whatever it is, sales. And A/B testing is a symptom of the problem. Mm-hmm. The main problem is a desire to optimize for whatever it is you want to optimize for, clicks, sales, whatever it is. And then A/B testing is one, maybe it's the only, but I imagine there's other kinds of ways you might try to get to that optimization point. If you're looking to optimize X, which is to say, get X as high as it could possibly go, and that's the one goal, and you've got no other guardrails, then if stomping on people's interests is on the way to maximizing X, then you'll go do it. And A/B testing is, it seems to me, one manifestation of that, but not the core of it, if you like.
I think you're right that there is a sort of a reinforcing loop here, that A-B testing is driven by over-quantification or a kind of a metrics-driven culture. And we hear this about so many Silicon Valley companies, particularly, right?
Yeah,
they're data-driven to the extreme. But it also then it feeds back and it helps to feed that culture. It helps to accelerate that culture because it positions product development in purely quantifiable terms. And as such, intangible benefits or harms tend to drop off the agenda.
These things tend to be
conducted for a very short amount of time, as basically as short as you can get it. So you get statistical significance. And then they tend to just ship, right? If it works for 50% cohort or a 10% cohort, you tend to go to a 99% or 100% rollout fairly soon. And so it causes the sort of dropping off of any potential long-term impact, any real consideration on, is this in the user's interests over the course of a year, for example, you know, what effects it will have on loyalty. So I think they sort of feed off each other. But you're right, the root cause is ultimately this sort of potentially harmful metrics culture. Yeah.
And let me try to push the point a little bit more even. I'm trying to think about how much it matters that it's an experiment. Mm. So one thing that you were highlighting earlier is, especially the OkCupid case and the Facebook case, they're experimenting on people so that such and such happens. And they're also taking away from, diminishing the work of expert product designers, coders, whatever it is. And suppose I say, maybe the experimentation matters, but I would think it's just the way in which they actually impact them. Now, take a case where I don't do any A-B testing, and I just have a really savvy product designer. And he really knows how to get people to click, or he really knows how to get people to buy. And so he's really good at optimizing X. Now, he's not performing an experiment. Mm-hmm. I've even said, as the head of the company, it's whatever Kenneth says. Kenneth is the freaking product guru here. So if he says we're going to design it this way, we're going to design it that way. If that's the shade of blue that he calls for, that's what we're going with. No A-B testing. But suppose we wind up with something that's functionally equivalent to what we would get in the A-B testing case. You say, we're going to make the algorithm like this, it's going to maximize engagement. Now, does it cause depression among teenage girls and political divisions and blah, blah? Yes, but he nailed it. Kenneth nailed it. And so I wonder if the problem is, I'll put the question a little bit more open-ended, which is something like, to what extent is the problem that there's experimentation going on as opposed to there's just bad shit being done and optimized for?
Okay. So you're right. This is an important sort of objection, if you like, to my claim, which is that, well, what's the alternative? Why should we be concerned about an A-B test that shows potentially bad stuff to 50% of the user base when an alternative might just be what's doing it to all users without testing it? And surely that would be worse, right? This sort of just ship it method. Maybe that's more risky. Maybe that's going to, you know, increase the harm because you're potentially relying less on empirical evidence, you might think. In truth, there are no companies, maybe with the exception of Apple, but certainly not even modern Apple, maybe 10, 15 years ago. But no companies will give that amount of power to any one designer or product manager, even a VP.
Sure.
What they will do is if they are going with this sort of just chip it method, they will pair careful iterative design with usability testing, with upfront user research, and hopefully with longitudinal studies so that you can gather more information about potential impacts on users, not just in terms of how they click and behave within your product, but also do they actually improve users' lives? Do they help them succeed in a task they're trying to achieve and so on? So within that just chip it method of product development, there is actually still scope and space for these morally salient bits of feedback, if you like, to re-enter the system. If you have a researcher who's skilled enough to look for those issues and raise them when they say, well, here are the summaries of what we found. Yes, it performed, but then you have an opportunity to accommodate that and hopefully mitigate. So the safeguards, if you like, with that just chip it method in practical senses are more robust and reliable than they are with the A-B testing, than a pure A-B testing reliance, which gives you no real appetite or opportunity for that type of information to make its way back to you. You might hear about it post facto in customer service complaints 6 months, 18 months down the line, or you might have a reputational catastrophe because you've horribly misunderstood something. But without any real way for that information to enter the business before release, then you're kind of digging your own hole.
So let me see if I have this right. You say Let's see if I get the narrative of the arguments right. So you say, look, this experimentation, this A-B testing experimentation, morally objectionable. It encourages treating people like beasts in a cage to be experimented with. And thus, they get experimented with in bad ways, bad algorithms, blah, 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 getting lied to, potential harms, actual harms. Okay. And I say, is it the experimentation or is it just the treatment? Wouldn't we have the same thing if we had no A-B testing, no experimentation? In a sense of that word experimentation. And we just had, as you put it, just shipping it mentality. And I think that you haven't said, no, there's something special about experimentation that makes it morally worse. I think what you said is, I'm going to put some words in your mouth, and then I'll say the words that I think that you did say. Yeah, it would be just as bad, but pragmatically speaking, the just ship it approach is more amenable to interventions of the ethical variety than A-B testing, because there's something about the culture and the practice of A-B testing that makes people resistant and or deaf to complaints of a sort of a moral or ethical
variety. I think that's accurate. I think, yes, you know, spherical horses in a vacuum type sense, right? Then yes, if we did have a just ship it process that was purely genius driven without those opportunities for feedback, then that could potentially be just as morally problematic as experimentation. But in the real world, yes, that's not how it's structured.
Yeah.
And instead, then we have this reinforcing loop whereby testing encourages more of that over quantified mentality and forecloses even more of those opportunities to get that morally salient feedback into the organization.
So I guess that's my next question. A-B testing is not going away.
For sure.
Right? This is not the sort of thing that we say, okay, down with A-B testing. And so the right answer is presumably, what's the right or what's the wrong ways of doing A-B testing? And broadly speaking, of course, the answer is going to be something like, do it ethically. Do it in a way that doesn't treat people as beasts to be experimented with. Mm-hmm. But is there more? I know there is. What's the more substantive thing to be said about how to reform A-B testing so it takes account of these concerns?
Right. So the obvious approach is then you map the mitigation, if you like, to the risk. So you look at the particular context that you're operating in. If you're working in healthcare, for example, then to my mind, you must have a much higher bar, because it's already been established that, you know, the delivery of healthcare is digital as much as it is face-to-face these days. And so if you're A-B testing how often an insulin meter takes its results and feeds it to the app, then I think you've got a problem, because a randomized control trial, that's a legitimate health intervention that needs to go through all of the healthcare protocols for testing, common rule and things like that. So you look at the context, you look at obviously the harms that might be done to the user. I think there is also an important role to play in looking at, do you have a social role? So for example, I would say certain news organizations and news orgs test heavily, A-B test headlines, particularly a great deal.
Yeah.
But maybe you have a responsibility if you're an organization such as the BBC, a purportedly non-editorial information giving news service, then you almost have a sort of an epistemic duty, right? To inform the public in a way that everyone can understand what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. If you fragment and you say, well, let's show half of these people this headline and half this headline, you're giving a different story to different people. So maybe you're not honoring that epistemic obligation you have to the social knowledge base, if you like. So looking for those, as I say, those specific use cases where there is elevated risk of harm. And then obviously it depends on whether you find yourself in one of those. If you do, then yes, there are certain protocols you put in place. One might be, yes, this higher consent bar. Because right now what's happening is companies are jamming this in terms of service. They're saying, well, it's in terms of service. Mm. The user is required to read TOS as part of the use of the site. Therefore, we're fine.
Sure. No one
does.
Yeah.
You know, that is not a particularly plausible claim.
At best, it's a legal protection. It might not even be that. And it's certainly not an ethical protection.
It's an attempt at a legalistic view of consent and certainly not an ethical view of consent. Yeah. So my argument is that at the very least, there ought to be either a genuine attempt to get people to read those TOS, in which case you'd better rewrite all those TOS to make them genuinely readable, which, good luck. Mm-hmm. Or you should probably tell people, hey, do you mind if we do experiments? And you might see a different version of the app. And here's what we'll do with the results. And then particularly, you should allow people to withdraw. If they don't agree to that, then I don't think you have much more authority to say, well, we're going to do it anyway, which is effectively what happens today. Yeah. So I think there needs to be disclosure. I think there needs to be the ability to withdraw. There needs to be exclusion for vulnerable populations, particularly children. I think it's astonishing that we allow children to be put in these A/B test cohorts, but it does happen. And there should be some probably broad consent model where at least users can specify, okay, but leave me out of this stuff. Right. So broad consent, the idea that, you know, you can kind of give someone permission to make decisions on your behalf, but you can scope that. You know?
Yeah. All right. So let me try to push on this. It's a bit devil's advocate, but a bit not. I think that getting people to read stuff is a non-starter. Forget that. Even if you write it in so that a 10-year-old can understand it, it doesn't matter. If it's a paragraph and you can just click the box, you're going to 99% of people on the planet are going to click the box. I'm including myself. Mm-hmm. Just give me the service. Just shut up. Just give me the thing. I'm too impatient to read. Fine. Mm-hmm. Take my data. I don't care. So I think clicking the boxes or simplifying the terms of service is probably a non-starter. Even if it'd be nice in an ideal world, I think it's probably a non-starter. You're going to welcome to push back on that. The thing that I really want to push back on that's because I think it's more devil's advocate, but I want to think a little bit more about the consent stuff. Suppose I say this. It's to some extent, there's always got to be buyer beware to some extent. You know that you're going to get influenced in some way by, let's go with social media because that's the most obvious case. You're going to get influenced in some way by the feed that you get. You know that. You have to know that. Actually, if you didn't know that, then you wouldn't get onto the site. I'll go on to Facebook to watch certain videos that are either funny or instructional in nature. So I know how I'm going to be influenced more or less. And if there's some other stuff there that I don't like, I just swipe past. Anyway, I don't have a right to be unaffected. I don't think I have that. I know I'm signing up for this optional service. I think that's something worth highlighting. We're not talking about a service that you absolutely... Yes, there are probably some cases where in order to survive for your job, you've got to get on Facebook and do blah, blah. Put those kinds of special cases to the side. Most uses of Facebook, I take it, are voluntary. They're optional. They're recreational in nature. And I know I'm going to be affected. And so I don't know. I don't know how much of an obligation or how I should think about their obligations towards me to make me feel a certain way. If they make me feel shitty, why not just say, all right, I'm just going to stop getting on this site. And I also want to put to the side, kids are also a special case. They need special protections, I think. So I don't know. We're going to test out this algorithm. We'll put happier content over here and more depressing content over there and see how people react to it. I don't know. Again, this is a little bit devil's advocate, but there's a piece of me anyway. This is the skeptic inside of me that wants to say, I don't know. If you don't like the content, turn it off. If you like it, great. There is no neutral algorithm. They have to make some kind of choice. Anyway, I'm going to stop there. I mean, that's not a particularly coherent, compelling defense, but I'm at least gesturing towards something like buyer beware, take some personal responsibility. Of course, you're not going to be unaffected. It's a luxury good, not a necessity.
Yeah, I don't know. Sure.
Is any of that relevant to you?
So to an extent, I would push back on the idea that there is no neutral algorithm because, for example, Blue Sky does no moderation of content. It does no selection other than you tell it and it shows you, right? I followed these people that chronologically as social media.
But isn't that a decision?
I'm sorry?
Sure, but that's a decision. The chronological thing is a decision
that's
as
well. Communicated right? That's communicated to users is my point. So users know what they're going to get, right? The most common public feedback to the emotional contagion study was not, gosh, that's awful, how dare they toy with our emotions, but it was, holy shit, they manipulate the contents of my newsfeed. People didn't know that their newsfeed actually was algorithmically driven, that it was a selection of the large amount of content that was posted on Facebook. People genuinely thought they were getting a good old-fashioned chronological feed.
Okay, but that can't be the heart of the moral objection. I don't think so, because it's an easy fix. Tell everyone, hey, we optimize the algorithm that creates your newsfeed with an eye towards what we think you're going to like the most or what will get you most engagement. And I take it that if they did that and they did the emotional contagion thing, that you would still be objecting, right? Even though they've told everyone they're going to do crazy shit, you'd still find it objectionable.
So I think there are two angles here to my complaint here. One is that, yes, certain cases of A/B testing can lead to genuine harms to your well-being. And those were identified in those special cases that I started to talk about. But beside that, there's still, I think, something important about respecting people as autonomous individuals. You know, I can understand that as moral crimes go, this is not an enormous one. you know, I'm not saying we need immediate legislation and so on. Nevertheless, yes, I think it is legitimate to feel wronged, pissed off, not consulted, not properly informed, when essentially you are told, did you know that company X has been performing essentially psychology experiments on you without your knowledge for 10 years, which is what's happened with social media. I think people would be rightly upset by that. Because as you say, the fix is kind of simple. It's like, oh, they just could have told me and offered me the choice. And then lo and behold, you know, that objection goes away. It's that lack of disclosure, I think, is at the heart of that lack of respect for autonomy. You know, and if we believe that these things will genuinely improve the product and people's life, then surely they would have an incentive to say yes. Why do we feel we have to keep it secret? It's not because it's going to invalidate the experiment, because there's a lot of evidence from nudge studies, for example, that show even if you tell people about the intervention and its nature, it's just as effective. So it's not going to invalidate, and it's unlikely to invalidate results. So why the need for secrecy when I think there is an affront to autonomy?
I think I want to say that you're being too easy on them.
Okay.
I know that might be true. So this is the other side of things, right? So before I was saying you're being too hard on them, individual autonomy, and let them know what they're getting into. It's a luxury good. But now I want to go the other way and say, it's a boogeyman. Yeah. It's not the real thing, because there's consent, and then there's different levels of consent. There's different ways of consenting. There's reasons for consenting. Here's an analogy or a similar kind of case. I don't know if it's going to have the grip that I wanted to, but I was talking to a friend the other day and I was complaining about the LinkedIn algorithm because I have tens of thousands of followers on LinkedIn. And for a while, I was getting lots of reactions to my content there, likes and reshare. And sometimes I still do, but a lot of times my content, it's shown to literally hundreds of people. I've 27,000 followers and it's shown to 300 people. So what the hell is the point of having followers if you're not going to show my stuff to my followers? The people who have said, follow this guy. And my friend, who's in the design world and computer science world and knows this world very well, he said, what do you expect? It's just a platform. They don't owe you anything. They didn't tell you they would never down throttle your stuff. And I want to say, yeah, you're right. They never made a promise, but it's just an asshole move. Obviously, his claim was they want me to pay for thought leadership ads or something like that. Now, maybe he's right, maybe he's wrong. Let's put his empirical claims about the LinkedIn algorithm to the side. I think it's an asshole thing. So now, if you had said 5 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever, when I was on LinkedIn and my stuff was being seen by people more, you said, listen, this is how it's going to go for a while. We're going to show your stuff to thousands or tens of thousands of people. And then eventually we'll probably turn down the volume and a lot fewer people are going to see it. Do you want to post? Do you consent? Or do you want to get off the platform? I would say, oh, shit. Okay. I hereby consent. Mm-hmm. But I still think, what a bunch of assholes. Again, I'm not saying this is actually descriptive of how LinkedIn operates or anyone's intentions over there, anything along those lines. Because if they hear this, they'll down throttle me more.
Right.
But I want to say the same thing about the Facebook thing where, maybe they say, hey, listen, you're going to get this free service, this Facebook, you're going to get your newsfeed. We're going to do various things with it in order to see what you like and improve the site and make it, frankly, profitable for us, but also useful for you so that everybody wins. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Okay, fine. And then they do some crazy or somewhat experiments that I think, I guess I consented to that, but still, what a bunch of assholes. So I don't want the consent thing. This is me pushing against consent as being a kind of, you're in the moral clear now. I think that it's, letting them off too easy if you think that just getting consent, even explicit consent, go ahead, do it, is enough to absolve them of moral responsibility.
Now, to be clear, I think that's, I don't even know if it's sufficient, but I think it's, I'm really talking about the ideal case where I don't see any sort of more than minimal harm. Right. It's like, even if you are just testing 41 shades of blue, I think I still would like to know that you're doing that because you're making me the subject of an experiment. If there are these graver risks to my welfare, then, I think consent is potentially part of it, but it's certainly not the only thing. Yeah. I mean, don't forget, I live in what was once called Europe, right? I still see cookie banners everywhere. And the problem with consent is it individualizes a problem that frankly masks, or it's a solution that masks a structural deficiency in how people's data is bounced around services in all sorts of problematic ways.
Two things. One, I once lived in a country called Europe is a good name for an article about something or other. I'm not sure what exactly, but you should write that article. The second thing to say is, I wonder if you have the same reservations around physical billboards or something along those lines, where they're we're going to put out these billboards across London. Some are going to be light blue. Some are going to be dark blue. You got questions about isolating variables and stuff. But would you find that objectionable because they're experimenting on you? And let me put the question even broader. Is all marketing, to some extent, objectionable to you because it's trying to see if it can get you to do X?
So that, on that latter question, actually, the Oxford O'Hare Institute, where I've been based doing my studies for the last few years, the head of that institute has actually written in his early career, he did write a paper on essentially is advertising inherently unethical? And his conclusion was yes.
Yeah.
If it's non-informational, mm-hmm. if it goes beyond information giving and attempts to purposively change your emotional state in any kind of way. Now, that's an extremely harsh view that I think most people wouldn't support.
Yeah, that would be the view that having a brand is unethical.
I do think there is significant danger that comes when technology companies, but indeed any company, attempts to manipulate emotion in a way that is likely to instill negative emotion. I have problems with the use of negative emotion persuasion. For example, insurance products and adverts that would focus, say, on, you know, the fear of burglars entering your home, rather than the positive message of the security of knowing that you are protected against these risks. I see far less problem with that.
That. So here's why. Some negative emotions are so-called negative, but they're perfectly appropriate. They're apt, they're justified, they're rational. In some cases, it would be irrational not to have those quote-unquote negative emotions. I take it by negative, you mean something like unpleasant to have. But unpleasant to have doesn't mean irrational or unwarranted or inappropriate.
Agreed.
Suppose you're in a neighborhood where literally every other house is getting robbed. And they say, every other house is getting robbed. That means you've got a 50% chance of getting robbed. Don't you want insurance? Because 50% chance of getting robbed. I think, yeah, that's reasonable. And someone says, holy shit, I'm so afraid of getting robbed. That seems like a reasonable fear. It's not a pleasant sensation to have, but I wouldn't lobby against the ethically the inappropriateness of the negative emotion.
I think it's a valid response to
outrage.
Have.
How about moral outrage? Moral outrage. I guess people love feeling moral outrage. Maybe that's a positive emotion.
There's a certain sort of macabre enjoyment of that, isn't there? I agree with you that I think it's an appropriate moral reaction to be fearful in that type of situation.
Yeah.
I'm much more concerned about the exploitation of that fear for profit and the heightening of that fear so a company can benefit.
Yeah.
Particularly when, I don't know if I believe this, but let me throw it out there. Maybe I could argue that for every negative, or again, let's be more clear about negative, any emotion that is distressing in some kind of way that is unpleasant to have, there is a positive spin or a resolution to that that might be just as effective. Now, it might be that's an empirical claim. You need to look into it. But if I could argue, instead of pulling the fear lever, you pull the safety lever, the reassurance lever. And instead, I'm much more comfortable with the idea of profiting essentially through the furtherance of a positive emotional state in an individual rather than reinforcing a negative emotional state in the individual.
Oh, yeah, okay. So there's so much to talk about here that we definitely can't get to it all.
Right.
One, so there's, I guess, two things that I want to say. One is, there's this question that you ask. I'm comfortable you making a profit this way, but not that way. And there's a way of asking that question, or maybe there's just a way of hearing that question, where making a profit is prima facie morally suspect. If you're making money, there's something morally problematic about that at the start. And so if you're going to do it a good way, okay, fine, I'll acquiesce. But if you're going to do it in this bad way, it's extra bad because you're doing it for money. And so one thing I just want to register is I'm not convinced it's in fashion to hate capitalism right now by some people. But I don't know. I think making money is a perfectly morally acceptable thing to do, especially making gobs and gobs of money to the exclusion of other people living a minimally decent life. Yes, morally objectionable. Making a good upper middle class living, that seems totally fine to me. It's just funny, not funny, but it raises an eyebrow to me when people say, look, they're doing that to make money. And I'm, that would be problematic if making money were a problem. But if making money is morally fine, then I don't know what you mean by the sort of the shadow that you're casting on their motives, because they're doing it to make money, as though that's a bad intention, inherently intrinsically bad motive or outcome or something like that. So that's one thing to register.
Sure.
Now I've gone on such a rant. I've lost sight of the other thing that I wanted to say. Oh, the negative emotion thing. I think that you're right that there are certain cases that we can point to where people are feeling things like fear and anxiety and stress, and we take advantage of them. And I think there's this interesting phrase of taking advantage of, where there's something really problematic with it. Other times, we sell them something, let's say antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication for chronic cases, and we're doing it because of their fear, or there's all sorts of things that we give to people because they feel not unreasonably afraid or anxious, and addressing the fear and anxiety they feel seems to me like a perfectly appropriate thing. So I think that there's the question is where and how do we draw the line of when it's taking advantage of those emotions and thus, say, fomenting a political revolution and storming a capital, for instance, versus appropriately engaging with some negative emotions that people have because we're human.
I think that's a fair point. That kind of clinical counter is a good one. Maybe there's something different there because the administration of, say, an SSRI, an antidepressant, is done individually in the patient's best interests by a trained professional rather than at distance by a marketing company. There seems something morally salient about that I would need to dig in to figure out why I'm reacting that kind of way. Maybe that's a bit of a get out.
Suppose I say it's because there's a sort of doing it for the purpose of making money to you. This is just speculation. Is morally suspect.
So to that question then, I think there is clearly much about capitalism that is questionable, the way it's currently practiced. I have no problem with the idea of consensual exchange of value, right? If someone wants something and someone wants to pay for it, what they believe to be a fair price for a fair product, great, go at it.
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, making profit in that kind of way really, you know, like yourself, I don't think it has anything morally suspect about it.
Yeah.
We all should live in that system, or we do at least. But that's not where we are right now. I think that foundational principle is sound, but the practices of wealth accumulation, of resource depletion, that result from that being taken to alarming extremes, I think it's right that we question it. But the thing is, I'm not a political philosopher. I'm not really qualified to interrogate the ethics of capitalism in that kind of way. There are people who are better placed. I think there is a lot to question about modern industrial growth capital or capitalism or post-industrial, wherever we find ourselves for sure. But that foundational exchange of making money by selling a valuable product, no, I don't have beef with that at all.
Yeah, so I didn't think that you would or that you do. I wonder, though, the extent to which there's a kind of disgust with the excesses of capitalism or something along those lines that pours over into your disgust for, maybe disgust is too strong, distaste for, and the suspicion that if they're doing it in a way, or you can use the words like this, preys on negative emotions, then it's morally objectionable or suspicious. But why not just say instead, being overly greedy is bad, the excess of capitalism, that's bad. Marketing as such, it's fine, unless it's amounts to, among other things, taking advantage of people. And then we get to be more fine-grained about what constitutes or taking advantage of someone, as opposed to a wholesale rejection of speaking to people's negative emotions, so-called negative emotions.
I mean, obviously, you know, this in a short conversation, you're right, we're going to be losing some of that fine-grained detail. And this is an interesting point because I do wonder whether cultural influence comes into play here. So I started my career working in the UK as a business advisor for basically a government help desk for small business owners or people who wanted to start a business. And so they used to ring and say, well, how do I do it? Is there funding I can apply for? What regulations do I need to follow? All this kind of stuff. And I was like,
it's so un-American.
Well, we just freaking do it.
And then we worry about if there's a whole law later.
I mean, this is partially true. And one of the things that I read as part of the research into the role and as I was doing it is there is a significant cultural disparity between the US and the UK in attitudes to entrepreneurship. In the UK, certainly at the time, so this would have been around about early 2000s when I started that role, 50% of all murders committed on British television were by small business owners. I have no idea what that figure is in the United States or elsewhere. But there is culturally, I think, a suspicion of
the entrepreneur. So interesting.
And particularly, yeah. Obviously, now that, you know, the billionaire executive, you know, et cetera. I mean, look at the reaction to the slaying of the health executive, health executive in New York. There is clearly a cohort of people for whom, although they're not condoning the murder, they still would say, well, if you find yourself after you get murdered, if people are celebrating. So there probably are, you know, there are going to be some people for whom there's skepticism about the entrepreneurial attitude, if you like, and the predisposition to exploitation that it carries. I don't know. Maybe I do carry that. I've not really interrogated it in much detail. I'm not one of those people praising the slaying of the chief exec, for example. I think that's obviously morally ludicrous that we should support that.
I guess Christians can't really be either. That's not a great line for Christians, right? If you find yourself getting executed and most people are happy about it, that probably didn't do so well. I mean, that... You can't be a Christian.
Right. Well, and, you know, Jesus wasn't particularly fond of the moneylenders, I hear, for example. So there are some inconsistencies, I suppose, if you're an ultra-capitalist and a Christian as well. But then I think there are a lot of inconsistencies in the modern Christian story. But yeah, I wonder about the power of culture there and that might have shaped our respective beliefs.
Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you for what it's worth. I do sometimes feel myself raising an eyebrow at things that I'm like, is it really that's an ethically problematic, or is it this sort of in the ether and the sort of political realm that I occupy, social political realm that I occupy, there is a raised eyebrow at capitalism. Mm-hmm. But then we actually have to poke around and see if that's accurate.
I would agree with that. I think, I mean, let's be candid, there is potentially a problem, I think, the tech ethics community has had of late, which is that people who aren't maybe deep enough into the ethical content of it are often using that label when what they're really talking about is the political.
They're activists.
Essentially, they're pushing for activist agendas under the cloak of ethics. I mean, even look at Gamergate back in 2014-15. This was a hate campaign against women and trans people in the gaming industry, essentially. And I was working at Twitter at the time, and it was all happening through Twitter, so I saw quite a lot of it. But it was conducted under the label of ethics, and it was a journalistic ethics crusade. I would wager the people that were part of this campaign really didn't know anything about ethics and were just using that as a cloak to advance a particular political agenda, which has since gained a lot of ground, shall we say. It was kind of, Gamergate was a good test bed for some of those policies and approaches.
Luckily, it was the last time anyone ever used the call of ethics to justify their actions.
Quite, yes. You know, that's phew. Glad we're free of that problem now. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Kenneth, this has been great. So much. Thanks so much for coming on. I really do like this focus on A/B testing and the way in which, you know, just culturally, this is how things go, and it raises the kinds of problems that you've articulated, and also then raises deeper questions about ethics of consent and marketing generally and manipulating human behavior. Great stuff. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, everyone, for listening. And now let me thank the people who have made this podcast possible. So first of all, we have Delano Alexander. He's been with me since day one. He showed me even how to start recording a podcast in the first place. He does editing stuff. He's been fantastic, and he does really everything I ask him to and more. I've never met anyone else who just says so much. Yeah, I don't know how to do that, but I'll figure it out. What more could you ask for in a producer? Next up, Jennifer Strong, my podcast guru. I don't know what else to call her. She just has advised me on how to design the podcast, how to grow it. And she's responsible for, if you like, this kind of season 2 relaunch and everything around it. So thank you to you, Jennifer. Next up, Meg Marco, responsible for all the excellent artwork. Before I did the artwork, I didn't really know what I was doing. We put it together. It worked well enough. But I think Meg really did a phenomenal job bringing everything together. Garrett Lang, sound engineer that I frankly don't deserve. He's just too good for this podcast. Don't tell him I said that, though. Next up, Benjamin Kultgen. He is a professor of philosophy who has helped me source guests, identify who's interesting, who has things to say, etc., etc. So without him, I wouldn't have anyone to talk to. And then finally, Ashley Wasilenko, who helps with all manner of administrative things, making sure that the podcast guests find their way to the podcast, can schedule the recording, get their bios and headshots, and really just keeping the show on the rails and me organized. Thanks to all of you. Really appreciate all your hard work.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.